Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. My name is Kat. I am a registered psychologist and I'm one of your co-hosts.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist, and I'm the other half of the Psychology Sisters.
Woohoo! Amy, it has been 100 years since we have recorded together.
It has been 100 years since we've recorded together, and I'm so stoked to be recording with you again, just you and me. Although I love our interviews, it's, you know, it's just something nice about sitting down with you, talking things that we love and are passionate about. And
I like when interviews we can't be like really silly sausages, like we have to be like, you know, there has to be some element of professionalism. But I feel like on the OG podcast
we can really let our freak flag fly, can't
we? Yes, we absolutely can. I think that really comes with the job in mental health. My darling Amy, please tell me your pit and peak.
Oh, well, my peak has to be that in 4 days, my future fur baby will arrive into the world, will be earthside and grace me with he or her, hopefully he's present, because I already have a name picked out. So I'm going to be the owner of a dog, which is probably my favorite title to date, dog owner. Ha ha ha.
You're going to put that on your resume.
Yeah, instead of like master of psychotherapy, it'll be like dog owner of...
Do you like the post nominals, like DDOWR? Make it look so professional. Well, that's so exciting. Little Mowgli is coming.
Little Mowgli is coming. Cannot wait. Days are going super slow.
Counting down the days.
Counting down those days. But I'm also on holidays from my full-time job. Obviously still have my lovely psych collaborative clients, but my full-time job, because I work with children, I'm on school holidays, which is so lovely to not have anywhere to be. I can just take my time. The simple things like having a slow morning, so underrated. I love just like getting up, taking my time at the gym, coming home, you know, doing whatever I want really, which is nice. Slowing it down, pausing after a few hectic weeks. I don't know about you, Kat, but I've had a huge spike in suicidal ideation and self-harm over the last few weeks. So I definitely am feeling the effects of that. I know if you are a, you know, psychologist or, you know, other mental health care worker and you listen to this podcast, I wonder if that's something that you can relate to. Because Kat and I have definitely been feeling the effects of increased anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation over the last few weeks. And I guess I don't really have a pit. So Kat, please take it away. What is your pit and peak? How's your week?
Before I jump into that, definitely been a couple of hectic weeks for you, Ains. I know I'm just doing constant risk assessments with you, making sure you're okay. I'm so happy you're on holiday, so you have some time to chill, although you don't often chill. So I will be interested to see how often you are actually chilling. No, my week has been wonderful, busy. As you said, it's a really, really busy time of year. Lots of clients going through a lot of stuff at the moment, but you know, it's part of the job. And yeah, it's been a really productive week, I will say. I do have a pit and a peak. Peak being that I am loving longer days. Longer days are making just my life so much happier. I can get home after a really busy long day and I can still go for a walk and go into nature. And it really does something for my soul. It really feeds my soul. And I know you're saying that on a podcast a few weeks ago. And I'm so excited this weekend, daylight saving. It's a real difference in our lives. You're getting a dog and I'm excited for daylight saving.
Hey, but do you know what daylight savings means? Daylight savings means that there'll be more opportunity for us to walk my dog when I get it.
Good reframe.
I think you will definitely be godmother.
Are you asking me out on the podcast to be your godmother?
Yeah. Will you please be Mowgli's godmother?
Your godmother. I am honored. I am absolutely stoked. Oh my gosh. What's my responsibility? So a godmother, let's really just define this role. If your Andy pass away, and I really hope that doesn't happen, but in the event that it happens, I get to keep Mowgli. Is that...
You are responsible for Mowgli if in the, you know, God forbidden circumstance that you were to lose.
I don't want to say that I want something bad to happen to you guys, but I would be extremely happy to get it. No, I'm kidding. I'm touching wood. That's really bad juju to put to the universe. But I'm honored.
You've all heard it here. If I disappear after I get a puppy, you know what happened.
Yes, the psychosis has really come to fruition with that name. Yeah, so my pit is that I've been wanting to share this story for so long, and it was a story long time in the making. Josh has offered some critical feedback of my storytelling, so I will try and keep this short and sweet. He thinks I get lost in the details, so I'm a bit self-conscious.
I love the details.
I'm a bit self-conscious of this story, but I'm going to just say it really quickly. I haven't prepared, but I'm just improv. So
you've secretly prepared this all day, haven't you?
I do have palm cards, so I will be. I just laminated them. So over the past 9 weeks, I have been running a social skills and emotional regulation group for a group of children. There are 6 children in this class. The children are very low functioning autism. And I would say that it's been probably the hardest experience, like the hardest clinical experience of my professional and personal life, if I'm honest. I've seen children and I have seen adults and I've seen a whole range of complexities with clients, but oh my God, running 9 weeks of an hour class after school on a Tuesday that finished at 5 p.m. for 6 children who didn't know each other, had very different sensory tolerances. Oh my goodness. I just, hats off to I just don't know how teachers do it. When I used to work in a school with you, Ames, teachers are, I already knew they're amazing, but yeah, for this group of kids, it was like chaos. It was just so difficult to talk to them and connect with them. And I think I'm so used to having those one-on-one conversations with children and clients that to have 6 of them, just, yeah, I found it really overwhelming and really challenging. It's been a really awesome learning curve. And I wouldn't say it's a pit. That's probably the wrong word for it. It's just been a really interesting learning.
Challenging.
So challenging. And all the different children have different sensory sensitivities. So one child is very, perhaps was quite loud. And then another child was really sensitive to loud noise. So there was lots of different negative feedback loops that was happening in the class. So yeah, it was just, I guess, managing that and teaching them emotional regulation and social skills was really challenging. So hats off to all the teachers for children with special needs and, you know, teachers of children in mainstream schools, because I think it's the hardest job in the world.
Well, I think that's a huge win. Congratulations on completing 9 really challenging weeks.
I survived. I may have cracked into the Vidello when I got home from my social skills group and maybe a maladaptive coping mechanism, but yeah, it was nice to kind of finish up. And at the end of it, it was nice to see them grow and have learned some things. So that's all I could hope for. But yeah, it was so challenging.
It sounds like you're really downplaying your achievements there. It sounds like you found it really challenging, but you could also see huge progress that you made.
Thank you, despite
it being challenging. So well done. That's huge. Gosh.
Yes. A really tricky, clinical experience that I've had. I am just a little happy that it's
done.
But yeah, no, very great.
It's like a little celebration.
Yes. And I think it's like early career psychs and anyone in the mental health sphere, social workers, carers, I think you just kind of throw yourself into those opportunities. And I think I was just like, yeah, like, let's do it. Let's give it a whirl. And I'm not someone to think through things very, as you may know, I'm kind of just like, yeah, let's do it. You know, happy to give it a whirl and then
grab it and run.
When you're in it, you're like, oh, whoa, like, this is a lot. This is so outside of my comfort zone. And it's too late to go anywhere. Yeah. So yeah, no, it was a great learning experience. But yeah, just a bit of a toughie.
Toughy, but you got there. Well done.
Thanks, girl. Alrighty. We are going to jump Amy's dancing. We are going to jump straight into today's episode. Amy, tell me about today's episode. I'm so excited for it.
Yes. So this is your idea, Kat, the inner child. And I think this goes after your own heart being a
a child.
Or just being fun and loving, and I guess something that you always preach is not to lose play. So Kat was like, let's do an episode on the inner child, and let's explore what the inner child is, how we can nurture our inner child, how we can find our inner child. Kat will explain the function of play, imagination, and I guess, the importance of it in adulthood. We can go into nurturing our inner child, and then later on I will talk a little bit more about understanding trauma and the inner child. And then if we have time, we might go through some questions from our listeners on a recent Instagram post.
Yes, we have quite a few questions. I'm looking at them now and working up a light sweat with how we're going to get through them all. No, we will definitely get through them all some way or another. So yeah, it's inner child. I'm so excited to talk about this topic. It is something I'm so passionate about and something that I think gets lost a little bit, our inner child. So what is our inner child? So you've probably heard, you know, when you're playing in the park or when you're rolling around having fun with your partner or your friends or doing something silly, it's like, oh, I feel like I've released my inner child, or it's so fun to kind of be a kid again. So the inner child, it's really a metaphor for the part of our personality or the origin of our personality that resembles childlike qualities. So for example, innocence, naivety, creativity, playful, sometimes irrationality, and, you know, children who like to have fun. So parts of our personality that love to seek stimuli and have fun. So many believe that the inner child is the core of who we are, yet we've been socialized to think, act, and behave in certain ways to mature, in other words, to avoid social rejection of other adults. So the way I think of being an inner child is that we're all children inside. We all have not lost that little spark of a child who's curious, who's a bit whimsical, who sometimes gets lost in fantasy, who loves to play, who loves to connect with others, who likes to just have fun. I think inside of all of us, we definitely have an inner child. It's just as adults, we've kind of been socialized to think that that's not important, to that, you know, play and those childlike qualities, they, you know, we need to be more mature and focus on being an adult and responsible and serious and mature. So I think that this is such an important topic to breach on, because it is something that isn't really talked about and something that I know professionally and personally so many people don't realize it but are looking for their inner child and really have forgotten about that part of themselves. And then when we talk about it, it becomes, you know, a really fun thing to explore and reconnect with. So that's why I wanted to do today's episode on finding your inner child, and I think it's such an interesting thing. So Ames, before I kind of delve into some fun theories and ballistic statistics, would you believe, tell me about Amy. Tell me about the inner child inside Amy, and tell me if the inner child ever comes out.
Oh gosh, I don't know if we really want to delve into the inner child of Amy. I guess I have a slightly different framework of what the inner child is, I guess, just from a trauma perspective or from a psychotherapy perspective. And I think there's a lot of conflicting ideas about what the inner child is. And I don't think that there is a wrong or right definition, because it's not definitive. I think it's understandable because it is all of those things. You know, it is our ego, it is our unconscious, it's fun, and it's a part of your brain, which is part of your personality, and it's a part of your brain which has been affected by childhood. And the reason I like to explain it in parts or as a part is because it is not all of you. But that part of you, I guess, from a trauma perspective, may have stemmed from feeling unsafe or scared. You know, I also find using parts language can be really helpful for adults who experience a lot of shame or internalized shame stemming from childhood trauma. And I guess when we're exploring the inner child, the first question that we should be asking is not what's wrong with you, but what has happened to you. So I guess, yeah, I have a slightly different perspective in seeing the inner child as something that we can show compassion towards through, you know, connecting with our past experiences from childhood. And through that connection, we'll have a better understanding of how we came to be us, and I guess, yeah, our responses and the way we relate to the world. Now, I guess to answer your question a little bit about my childhood, I was an only child up until the age of 10. My parents separated, they were never married, when I was about 18 months old. So I never knew my parents together. I only knew, you know, mum separate to dad. I was always a super independent creative child because I had to be. Mm-hmm. I often entertained myself with a lot of creative play. My mum then remarried and had my little sister when I was around 11. And that dynamic was really volatile. I didn't get along with my stepdad. But I guess my childhood wasn't a negative one. And it sounds like that while I'm speaking about it now. But I remember my childhood. I always loved animals. I did a lot of horse riding. I had dogs from a young age. So animals were always a really big part of my life. And I still have that now. I feel like that is one of the things that I really associate my inner child with, is that sense of, you know, play and love for animals and the outdoors, because I think that is one of the most significant experiences I had as a child.
Mm, and it's funny how that comes through. Like, it's funny how your experiences as a child still really comes through in adulthood, sometimes unconsciously or subconsciously without realizing, because you're associating that the memory with pets as safe and fun and comfortable. And, you know, really, you know, you're seeking stimuli. You know, pets are very sensory and very tactile, and they're very comforting. And I think, you know, as Ames was saying, it's interesting, the concept of the inner child, because I think there is two prongs to this. The inner child that has suffered trauma, you know, if you're someone who has gone through some trauma, then your inner child will work very differently to someone who hasn't. And perhaps memories of your inner child won't be filled with that, you know, really playful, imaginative, safe space that you grew up as a child. Perhaps it's filled with those different feelings and emotional reactions and responses. So I guess, you know, in this episode, we wanted to touch on, firstly, if you are someone who has gone through trauma, and I know, Ames, you'll get into this into the episode, how to heal that child and how to look after that inner child. And secondly, as adults, how do we reconnect with that inner child? You know, why is it so important that we do this? You know, psychologically, neurologically, socially, it is so important that we do reconnect with our inner child, and we will get into that. So just for some really, really quick theory, I won't go too much into the theory side of things. So the concept of an inner child comes from expert psychiatrist Carl Jung, who explained a child's archetype in his work. Jung linked this internal child to past experiences and memories of innocence, playfulness, and creativity, along with some hope for the future. Our Soviet friend Vygotsky gets a nod here. He also did some work on understanding the function of play and imagination in children and how this relates to adulthood. So an inner child is an expression of not just your child self, but your lived experiences of all the life stages as a child. So your inner child is noted to be a source of strength and a source of creativity and a source of playfulness. Freud, our lovely friend Freud, feels that we are often driven by our unconscious mind, which often bears parallels to childlike qualities such as impulsivity and urges. We were all once children and still have that child dwelling within us, but most adults are quite unaware of this. I think when we reach this adulthood where, you know, as I said, we're socialized to think no more play, no more fun, work, get a job, study, work, marry, settle down, have kids of your own. And I feel like it's not until you do have kids of your own that you start to play again. And I think that as in adulthood, that's the first time that we really put focus, because we know how important play is for child's, you know, cognitive development, social development, emotional development. So I think, you know, parents, they may have more fun. They may engage in more play because they're forced to with their child. Adulthood hinges on acknowledging, accepting, and taking responsibility for loving and parenting our own inner child. For most adults, though, this never happens. The inner child becomes a mere memory and not something that we often think about a lot or pay a lot of attention to. We're told by society to grow up, to put childish things aside, to stop playing, to become adults. We've been taught that our inner child is immature, it's impulsive, and it's not something that we carry into maturation or adulthood. And often, you know, things like childlike qualities in adulthood, such as creativity, imagination, playfulness, sometimes those things in adulthood can be labeled as laziness, naivety, or immaturity. So you can see how as a child you would have been rewarded for being really creative and being exploring and having a really strong imagination. And yet in adulthood, it's almost like it's time to finish your creative pursuits, or it's time to get serious. And so adults, we're kind of suddenly like, or, you know, young, you know, teenagers even and young adults, it's like, oh, something that I was reinforced and rewarded for being a child is now suddenly I'm not supposed to do that. So you can see that this is around the time, I think in maybe probably late primary school, Ames. Is that kind of when you started to remember? Like for me, I think for me, it was late primary school when, you know, playing was not cool anymore. It was cool to kind of sit down with your friends and be really mature. Is that when you noticed it?
I think I was a really weird little girl. Even in year eight, I remember, and I think because I did have a little sister that was so much younger than I was, I played for a lot longer. And because I moved schools a fair few times as well, I didn't have like a really secure social connection or a really, well-developed social group when I got to high school and late primary school. So I think I played for a lot longer and I did horse riding on the weekend, which disconnected me from a lot of my peers. But yeah, I would say normally, yes, I think your age bracket late primary school is probably correct, where you know you start to reach that stage where you're going through puberty and you know you might be interested in developing more of an intimate connection. I know, you know, you start talking about, oh, you've got a boyfriend and oh, let's hold hands and those kinds of things, and we're not so interested in Barbie dolls and My Little Pony anymore. So yeah, definitely.
It's so sad when you said that. It's like death of childhood. It is really sad. Part of your development is when you start to not want to play anymore, not want to play with your siblings, not want to play with your friends. It's all about going out. And I think the focus does become on, you want to be grown up, don't you, as a child? Like that's your, you want to be seen as really grown up and really mature.
I think a big part of that too is we all want to be liked. And when we are in that stage of development, especially, we are so vulnerable to judgment from others. We don't want our peers to think that we are uncool or, you know, we all want to be liked. So I think a lot of our drive for our behavior around that stage is, I'm going to do this because I think that other people will like me for it, or I'm not going to do that out of fear of judgment.
And also school really is a template for right and wrong, isn't it? I mean, we're rewarded for right answers and not punished, but not reinforced for wrong answers. It's really black and white. And play is neither right or wrong. It's not something that's reinforced, is it? It's not something that's really rewarded when you're a child. It's just something that you do. So eventually, as we mature, especially in that primary school age, it starts to become, well, you know, if I'm getting rewarded for getting good marks on my spelling test but not for playing, maybe I should do more of the spelling test kind of things. And I think that's when the play starts to die down a little bit as well. It's the lack of reinforcement from parents. But you know, as an adult, we associate play with it's quite jovial, there's no function to it, it's just silly. But we know how important play is for development, and not just for children, for adults as well. And that's why I want to talk about this, because it's not really talked about among adults. So my dear evolutionary theory, they wanted to kind of understand the adaptation of play, the functionality of play. Why has it survived? Why are we still playing? What function does it serve for survival? So play comes in many forms and serves quite a wide variety of functions. So among the categories that research has found why play is so important and the function that it serves can be a few things. So the first one is to practice skills that are essential to survival. So it could be anything like you're running, you're jumping, your role play, you know, really setting you up for those situations. It's really good for problem solving, you know, when you're in a social situation, problem solving is really important and talking it out. It can generate some new creativity and some new creations, which could be, you know, really good for survival. It reduces hostility and enables social cohesion and cooperation. So play as a survival, just as a survival mechanism, is so important. And obviously it serves some function if it's been carried through and still to now. And we know how important it is for brain development and the development of so many things for children. And a child who doesn't play much, it wreaks such havoc on cognitive function, on their emotional regulation, and on their socialization. So play is so important across a whole range of things.
Definitely. And I think we often say, like in developmental psychology, children's language is play. Before we can walk, before we can talk, we play. So I think that is so true. And I think we overlook the importance of play a lot, especially in the developmental years.
Absolutely. A 2016 study found that a mother's responsiveness and engagement in play to her infant positively predicted higher cognitive capacities and skills, such as problem solving, knowledge and memory at 18 months. So that just really goes to show play with children is so, so important for a lot of things. So while play is so crucial for child's development, it is so beneficial across a lifespan. Play can add a lot of joy to our lives, relieve stress, supercharge our learning, and connect us to others and the world around you. Play can make work more productive and pleasurable, and it can make us engage in hobbies that we wouldn't have otherwise thought of. There's this really cool, when I was doing research, there's an adult preschool in Brooklyn, Amy, and it lets you on your lunch break, and you can go after work, you can fly drones, you can finger paint, you can do arts and crafts, and you can play. And I think that's so awesome. That's really popular. This adult preschool.
It sounds amazing. I want to go there.
Maybe we should set up one.
We're so shy.
I know. So play matters no matter how old you are. The only thing that's changed is the stigma. We associate play with childhood and therefore playing with childishness. However, that is absolutely not the case. So as adults, the structure of our daily life is so busy and we've drummed out a lot of space for natural and organic play. Instead, our routine is mostly exercise, work, social, hobbies, and sleep. And often we don't really have the time to play. It's not something that's front of mind, is it?
It's not prioritized.
No. So in adults, play helps to relieve stress, improve brain function, stimulate the mood and boost creativity, improve relationships and your connection with others, and also gives us a nice boost of serotonin and endorphins after playing.
Ooh.
Play is also really helpful in relationships. So you know, for example, when you first start dating someone, when you're flirting with them, it's almost like you're playing a little game with them, isn't it? You're kind of putting on a bit of a role play. You're playing that very, what's the word? Not hot and cold, but like a little bit of hide and seek. So, you know, play in relationships and play in long-term relationships is so important. It really fosters a sense of connection. I know lots of couples who really enjoy playing together in terms of like wrestling, chase each other down the hallway, playing games with each other. Board games is another really good one. So playing is really, really good for relationships and just getting an extra sense of closeness with someone. And play brings out a side of us that we don't usually bring out. There is, I think, inside everyone a little child who just loves to have fun and play. And I think, you know, when we are playing with people around us, or, you know, playing even just little pranks, I don't want to promote really big pranks, but just little fun things, it's so fun. And it brings out a side of us that perhaps we never knew, or we've really repressed for quite a while as adults who are serious. So there's a lot of benefits of play, and I think it's so important that we remember to unleash our inner child sometimes and have some fun.
Definitely. I think that's so important too.
Also, play can heal our emotional wounds. As we're talking about before, our inner child, perhaps if you experience any trauma, as adults, when you play together, you're engaging in exactly the same patterns of behavior that positively shape the brains of children. So these same playful behaviors and creative behaviors that predict emotional health in children can also lead to really positive changes in adults, specifically cognitively and emotionally. So for example, if an emotionally insecure individual plays with a secure partner, it can help replace those negative beliefs and behaviors with positive assumptions and actions. So really important that if you do have a partner who perhaps has some attachment concerns from childhood, playing with them can really help with their healing process.
Yeah, definitely. And just on that, I think when I think of the inner child, it's usually in reference to trauma work and connecting with our past experiences from childhood. So essentially it's reconnecting yourself at the time the trauma presented. For example, if you were 6 years old, typically the focus of the child work will be reconnecting with your six-year-old self. When we have reactions from triggers, past trauma, we act out from that child self, if that makes sense. So we might, for example, act out, lash out from those past experiences and then regress back to that of our six-year-old self's response. So We have all suffered trauma as children. Trauma does not have to be a huge event or something really extreme, such as sexual assault or physical abuse. It might be a volatile parental separation or a really critical parent. Or emotional neglect. As an adult, we tend to downplay these experiences because they are viewed from our adult lens, but that doesn't mean that how you experienced it when you were 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, that it isn't valid. Part of the reason as adults we invalidate and downplay these experiences is because it was scary. We do not always want to go back and revisit those uncomfortable and scary emotions. But it is from that part of ourself we often learn our maladaptive coping strategies and self-sabotaging behavior, because we're getting to the root or reason of why things may trigger you as an adult. So inner child work is kind of like a form of self-exploration or self-discovery, if you will, that helps you access the child you once were, along with the experiences and emotions that you may have been taught to repress. So it can be really terrifying to go back to that part of yourself, especially if you have learned to dissociate or avoid going there. A lot of this work is done when clients are mid-20s to mid-30s, because we need to be in a safe space to explore these often painful experiences and strong feelings. You know, we don't have the cognitive capacity to do this work in our adolescence. And we're probably still in an environment that induces our autonomic nervous system as well. So it isn't easy work. And I think that when we're working through trauma, or through a trauma lens, what we're aiming for is to develop a much more compassionate and curious understanding within ourselves. You know, trauma alters our nervous system and creates ripple effects from our experiences. I think it's really important to understand the process behind trauma and how it impacts us so greatly. So trauma, in terms of the way we're governed by our polyvagal nervous system, is something that we can neither, I guess when we experience it as children, it's something that we can neither escape or resist. So it's an intrusion on a perceived or actual attack that, like I said, induces our autonomic response, so our fight or flight. For example, growing up with a narcissistic parent, we get questions all the time on how to navigate, cope, manage a narcissistic parent. That is trauma. It's not a commission, it's an omission. So it is not something physical that we can see have an impact, but it does. Things like going to boarding school, emotional neglect, these types of trauma are difficult because usually people, when they're adults, will say, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, because it wasn't something that they can see that was done to them, if that makes sense. It's a real struggle with trauma because it's hard to name and identify.
And interpret, isn't it? It's hard. I mean, sometimes with trauma survivors, perhaps trauma survivors didn't realize how bad it was until, you know, they got to adulthood. And a lot of that has to do with cognitive capacity, but also a lot of people who do have repressed trauma don't deal with it, don't talk about it, don't think about it, don't want to make sense out of it. So it is really tricky to identify.
Yeah, definitely, especially if it's that omission trauma, because neuroscience shows us that trauma in that sense has the same impact on the brain as commission or physical trauma, such as physical or sexual abuse. I guess when we talk about children and you know, experiencing childhood trauma, even from infancy, like if we go back to being babies, babies are born ready for mirroring. We, you know, we get a sense of what facial expressions look like. You know, that's an evolutionary thing. We are attuned as mammals. And I mean, in terms of that narcissism example, parenting or parents who are narcissists will selectively mirror them for good things only. So this gives the child a sense that they are only lovable if they're pleasing their parents, not as a whole person. And that creates a real misattunement, which then leads to childhood trauma or creates that insecure attachment style as well. So complex or developmental trauma is a trauma that I tend to work with. And it's a combination of early and late onset, multiple. So it's repeated often in the family environment, oftentimes highly invasive and usually interpersonal as well. So it's ingrained in our relationships. A lot of adult problems have a background in child adverse experiences. For example, it might be something like just not having clean clothes And those adverse child experiences are the leading preventative cause of health conditions and mental illness. If you have, for example, think of it like this: cortisol running around your body constantly, your body thinks you're in a war zone. Most children who experience this will actually experience early onset puberty. And that's an evolutionary function to be able to pass on their genetic material, because their body perceives this as they're more likely to die early. Like, when we're adults, we don't see this as a big thing, but when you really look back at the impacts this has on us physiologically and psychologically, it is. It does damage. You know, I have a lot of clients that have complex trauma that experience puberty around 8, 9, and these people will experience early onset menopause as well.
And that also, I mean, having that experience as an 8 or 9 year old is also, I would say, also perhaps a little traumatic. Imagine having, I mean, that's quite early to have those early puberty signs and to go through that. That what I can imagine for a child of that age. That also can be quite confronting and confusing, especially for someone who perhaps has been sexually assaulted. To go through puberty early, it would be really tricky to understand and to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. On top of everything else that they're experiencing, they've got to learn to cope with a new body and a changing body as well. I guess the main thing I kind of wanted to highlight, and I know that this is very information dense, but like I said, I think it's super important to understand when we are looking at reconnecting with our inner child through the lens of trauma, is I guess neurodisruption and the neuroscience behind it. So these experiences on a little brain causes something called neurodisruption. And that little person, it might look like they're a naughty kid. So in schools, we might see that they are the kid that has been labeled naughty. They can't emotionally regulate themselves. They might have a hard time within their psychosocial functioning. And these social emotional impacts that stem from psychosocial disruption from trauma, they kind of create the teachers and I guess other adults and other people to label them. But there are two structures in the brain that are involved here: the amygdala and the hippocampus. So our midbrain limbic system that have special roles in remembering and our survival mechanism. Our hippocampus, think of it like your time and date stamp. The reason trauma memories are so different and are experienced so viscerally is because the amygdala turns off the hippocampus. So hippocampus is offline when the amygdala is activated. So there is no date stamp, so to speak, which is why we can feel like we're reliving the experience like it was yesterday when we're adults. So the excess cortisol stops the hippocampus from functioning properly when this happens, and an accurate time frame doesn't get logged. So what this means is the hippocampus may not register that the trauma's ended. So this is where we see things like flashbacks or, you know, trauma memories popping triggered.
Yeah.
Yep. And we experience it like it happened, you know, yesterday when it might have happened 10, 20 years ago. So trauma memories are also held in our implicit memory system, which is amygdala driven and non-conscious, as opposed to our explicit memory system, which is driven by a hippocampus, which is a conscious memory. There are also changes in our corpus callosum from a traumatized brain, but I won't go too much into that. I think what's important is just the understanding around the autonomic nervous system, because that is shaped from our environment. So for example, were you a child who hid under the covers or hid under the bed, or were you that child that ran around the house screaming, or, you know, swore back to your parents, or, you know, lashed out when you didn't feel safe or when something was happening? Our amygdala actually needs to feel safe. It's a visceral thing. It doesn't matter what words we say. It's, I guess in therapy, it's building up that relational buffering to be able to safely land. And as an adult, this can take 12 months plus. This can take years of work. And I actually think what's really interesting that Kat brought up is the concept of play, or the activity of play, and how play can be biochemically beneficial for us because it releases oxytocin, and oxytocin actually calms down our amygdala. So our brain is born ready to adapt. So if you're given a dangerous environment, your brain will be heightened and it will be alert, and you know, we'll have a robust stress response. So if we look at what's occurred in your lifetime and we kind of investigate or be curious around your brain and why it functions the way it does. People who have experienced complex trauma have a faulty neuroception, and they can't reliably or accurately determine whether a situation is dangerous or safe. What this might look like is if you have kind of like a faulty sense of safety, is being hyper alert, difficulty focusing, struggling to sit down and be calm, because you just don't have the capacity to. It's like telling someone to sit down and chill when there's a massive snake in the room. Like, you can't, you don't feel safe. You're not going to. Being in your sympathetic nervous system as a child greatly impacts our language processing, verbal development. So using language to describe how we are feeling is just not there. We don't have those abstract cognitions. So when we get to adulthood and someone goes, "Oh my goodness, why can't you just communicate? Why can't you just tell me how you feel?" Well, it was never safe to be able to explore our emotions when we were little, and when we were in that constant hyperarousal state. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this directly impacts our capacity to go inwards as adults. And I guess sometimes I think we lose sight of the underlying causes of behavior, and that's really what we need to tune into. And I guess neurodevelopmental psychology and trauma, they're adaptive responses. And I think if we don't understand them, if we don't notice where our shame comes from or where our emotional dysregulation comes from, if we don't understand the underlying cause of our behavior, we're not going to be able to, I guess, heal to have healthy attachments. We're not going to be able to maintain, or we're going to have a lot of difficulty maintaining healthy relationships in adulthood. And we're probably really going to struggle with acknowledging and sitting with our emotions. It takes a long time for our autonomic nervous system to update and tune in. But through things like Kat was mentioning, like active play, and I guess what we'll go into a little bit more later, by nurturing our inner child, I guess those are things that we will be able to achieve.
So yes, as Ames was saying, healing and nurturing your inner child is so, so important. So I'm going to give you some tips for ways to reconnect with your inner child, and Ames will give you some ways to heal and reconnect with your inner child from a trauma framework. So I think my first piece of advice would be to, if you're wanting to kind of rekindle and reconnect with your inner child, obviously we've talked about how important it is and how helpful it is for such a wide range of things. My first piece of advice would be to remember how you were as a child. Now, this would look very different for a child who has gone through trauma or has experienced a lot of really toxic home environments. But if you are someone who had a relatively stable childhood and you can remember some really positive memories, then this would be a really good activity for you to try. Going back to your childhood, what were some games that you loved to do? What made you feel really creative? What, you know, you can talk to your parents about this, or your siblings, you know, what kind of things, what were you like as a child? What kind of games did you enjoy? Did you like perhaps role play? Were you more of like a climb trees and get dirty kind of child? Were you more of like, you like solitary play, you like to play on your own, or would you like to kind of play with others, more cooperative play? So that would be my first piece of advice, is try to recall how you were as a child. What like, where did you have the most fun? I know for me, I was a dirty child. I loved just rolling in mud, and I loved just getting dirty and walking down into the bush, and just I was a lot more of a solitary player. I would just kind of be really imaginative. My best friend was a chicken, so I was very imaginative, just like you were, Amy. So those things for me, and you know, and still to this day, I really feel so content when I'm in nature. I feel so content when I'm exploring and trying new things and, you know, playing. That for me is my adult version of play, because that makes me feel like I've reconnected with my inner child. And it really brings back a lot of those, you know, fun, and it's fun to explore and try new things. My second thing would be to, how can we incorporate fun and play back into our adult lives? You know, it is something that we absolutely do mostly link with children, but it is so important that we do bring it back. And I think a really good place to start would be to start within your relationship. How can you bring fun, if you are in a relationship, sorry, how can you bring fun into your relationship? You know, and that can be anything like planning fun date nights, planning, you know, going golfing, rock climbing, if you can afford it, going exploring, going bushwalking, you know, finding that action that you can try and replicate as an adult. Perhaps you were really crafty as a child, so, you know, doing some craft classes together or pottery. So these things, while seemingly seem really novel and trivial and don't have much of a function, I promise you that when neurologically, from a science perspective, it absolutely does, and from a psychological perspective. So really important that we do connect with that inner child. Another thing we can try and do to reconnect with our inner child is to play with children. It seems really obvious, but children force us to be imaginative. Children are stuck in that really egocentric phase of their life where they're really imaginative. They're lost a bit of sense of reality sometimes. As I was saying before, new parents are forced to play with their kids, and they revisit their fun, and they often do report having lots of fun and report lots of things, a relief of stress and, you know, close bond with their child when they're playing and with each other as new parents. So those would be my top tips for finding your inner child. And I think also not putting too much pressure on it. I think, you know, as adults, we have such really serious responsibilities, and that's great. You know, I think as adults, we have this expectation that we need to be serious and mature and not silly at all. But I think psychologically, if you are never silly and you never have fun and you never play and explore and be creative, that actually really wreaks havoc on your cognitive development and your emotional development and your social development. So really important that you do make time in your schedule just to have some fun, to play games. Board games is another one, if that's something that you really like to do. I know in isolation, everyone is being forced to find their fun side, but, you know, don't forget about it when we're out of isolation. Don't forget about how much, you know, fun you're having and how important fun was for you. So those would be my top tips. Ames, do you have anything to add to that?
I do. I love your top tips. I think they are all wonderful tips.
Thanks,
and
girl.
I totally agree. I think, again, I probably sound like a broken record, but looking through the lens of trauma, I guess acknowledging that you have an inner child would be a great place to start. So honoring that as an adult, we all have a part of ourselves that is that inner child, and that helps us process trauma. So when we might bring up uncomfortable emotions and it might feel difficult, just honoring that that was a past experience, and that understanding and that honoring can help us process and move forward. I think my biggest, I don't want to say tip, but when I'm working with clients a lot around navigating the inner child or doing inner child work, because of the confronting nature of the inner child, sometimes it can be beneficial to look at childhood like stories. So whether that be through visualization or you make up a story about your own childhood, or another activity that I might ask a client to do is tell me their favorite childhood story. So stories communicate indirectly. A story does not spell out its meaning, but it kind of, you know, gives an interpretation according to how the individual is feeling or what their needs might have been. You know, it shows us something rather than telling us exactly what it is. It allows the person to kind of, you know, enact their meaning in terms of a character, or, you know, it might be part of what they recognize, I guess, something being true for them, or how they like to view themselves. It's examining the story that they remember. And it might just be a little bit of an easy way to construct an explanation to why that memory is significant to them. So it's a way of seeing the self, inverted commas, and the kind of person that they perceive themselves as. So finding stories to connect to our inner child can really, really help nurture our inner child. And I think also something that comes up a lot through inner child work, and is not something that I particularly practice a lot as a clinician, but you may have heard of reparenting. And it sounds a little woo-woo, but it's not. It definitely has a time and a place. So it is the idea that you basically reparent the needs that may have not been met for your inner child. For example, if you had critical parents, they were rule-bound, judgmental, dismissive of emotions, unapproachable, black and white in thinking. A child might think, I can never do anything right. Or opposite end of the spectrum, if you had rescuing parents that were overly protective or too involved or doing everything for the child that they might be able to do themselves, the child may then think, oh, I can never do anything. Or they might have incredible self-doubt. By exploring our inner child that way, we can ultimately improve, those needs that weren't met. And I guess that helps us improve our relationships as adults and our automatic responses. It's not about replacing our parents, but more about learning to self-soothe and cope with things a little bit differently through understanding why we are the way we are.
Maybe some affirmations. So for healing your inner child, if you did experience trauma, I think affirmations are so helpful, specifically when we are trying to reconnect to our inner child. So things like, I love you. I hear you. You didn't deserve to go through that. You did your best and you are loved regardless. I think affirmations like that, I forgive you, or I'm so sorry, that can be really helpful to start the healing process within your inner child if you did experience some really painful experiences and memories. So that's just another thing I want to tack on, is affirmations. And yeah, I think that can be really, really powerful.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if you are, able to identify something that your inner child maybe needed to hear. Mm-hmm. So exactly like you were saying, maybe you never felt loved. So saying I love you to your inner child, or I hear you, can
you're not,
be
you're not super, alone.
Yeah,
it can be a really powerful statement, can't it, for someone who has felt always alone or has felt that they weren't loved or that nobody heard them. Saying what you needed to hear as a child can be so, so powerful. And I think often people who experience trauma go through life wanting to hear this from other people and maybe don't realize that you can say this to yourself. I think the person that you need to hear it from the most is yourself. So affirmations, I think, can be so incredibly powerful for people who have gone through those traumatic experiences.
Definitely.
So we hope that was helpful in understanding, reconnecting and nurturing your inner child. We hope that you guys go and nurture that inner child and go and play and have some fun. It is so, so important to so many aspects of your life. So we both strongly recommend that you do both of those things.
Definitely. We had very different, perspectives or lenses today, which has been really interesting.
And I think that's also Ames. We've had very different childhoods, and I think, you know, it really exemplifies our childhoods, doesn't it? Our different experiences as a child. I know that you had such a really complex relationship with your mother, and you had, you know, your childhood memories are not always positive. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. And I think that's why we work so well, because we do offer these really different perspectives. And, you know, I know half of you guys listening will be able to 100% understand and relate to what Amy is saying with trauma and healing. And a lot of you won't. A lot of you probably have had, you know, what is it, 50% of us have a secure attachment. Is that the right statistic? Did I just, I hope that was right. So 50% of you will be listening to this and thinking, you know, I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I had quite a stable childhood. I can recall and retrieve a lot of really positive memories. So we wanted to offer, I guess, both sides of the spectrum. So if you are listening and you have experienced either one or the other, you can relate to both and reconnect to that inner child. It's so, so important as adults.
Yeah, definitely. And I did just want to say that if you are someone that is contemplating doing inner child work, and you do have trauma or complex trauma, because everyone does, it's actually really common. Like I said, it doesn't need to be a huge significant event. It might be that you've been really struggling with a narcissistic parent, or something like that. you don't have to see a psychotherapist to do inner child work or to do trauma-informed work. But if you are someone that does have complex trauma and you find turning inward quite painful or difficult or uncomfortable, the most important thing is that you seek professional support with someone that you feel comfortable and safe and connect well with, because it does, like I said, it does require that safe space to be able to do that experiential, you know, deep exploring of the self. That would be my take home, is if you are going to delve into Pandora's box, make sure you feel really safe and comfortable with your therapist. That's just something that I think is important.
And on the other end of the spectrum, if you're wanting to incorporate more fun and play into your life, that's also something you can chat to someone about. So if you're feeling really stressed and burnt out and feel like your life, you've lost a bit of passion, creativity, you've lost your mojo a little bit, that's also something you can absolutely reach out for help with. We hope you guys enjoyed it. We hope that was helpful in understanding why our inner child is so important and why we need to respect and honor our inner child in whatever way that we can. Alrighty, Ames, it is time for our questions of the week. We have only got time for two, but thank you to everyone for writing in. We will probably answer them all on a separate episode. So if you don't hear it, we will probably be answering it in an upcoming ep. But we did get quite a few, so we are doing our best to get through them. Each week, Ames, we get more and more questions. We're going to have to start picking and choosing a little more. So first one, question, Amy, how to embrace uncertainty and vulnerability?
I love this question, and I don't want to babble on too much answering it, but I would just challenge you by saying, when has anything ever been certain? Hasn't everything always been uncertain? And I think especially for the current climate with, you know, coronavirus and those kinds of things, we have brought up a lot that, oh, we're in really uncertain times, really unprecedented times. But if we look, when was there ever a time when things were certain? The only constant is change. And how do you usually cope or embrace things that change? I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind and challenge when you are feeling a little bit anxious or worried about uncertainty. And for vulnerability, I think vulnerability has a really negative connotation, but I don't necessarily think that it's negative to be vulnerable. I actually think it's really brave. So looking at your vulnerability as a strength, that it's really brave to sit with your emotions and your feelings and express yourself. I think that would be a really great way to embrace vulnerability.
Yep, perfect. I'm not even going to add anything onto that. Stellar answer, Amy, for the Monday night.
Thank you.
Okay, next question. And last question.
Next question is for you, Katniss, my little anxiety queen.
Every time you say that, it just makes me sound like I'm just really anxious, but I'm really good at it. I'm the monarch of anxiety.
Katniss, someone has asked how to know when to seek therapy for anxiety.
Great question. I think we've had this quite a few times before, but it is certainly something that has come under the microscope a lot, anxiety, particularly because of COVID this year and increased anxiety. I think anxiety is certainly something that has its positives, and that sounds a little strange, but anxiety can help us to motivate us to get that assignment in on time, to not be late for work, to, you know, motivate us in small ways. And some stress is good stress. But I think when anxiety starts to impact on your everyday life and your functioning, so whether that be your work life, your relationships, your social life, your inclusion in hobbies, if you felt like you've lost a bit of drive, if you feel a bit more like you're driven by fear more than anything, if you're really struggling with the somatic responses to anxiety, so if you're really noticing that heart rate, the sweaty palms, the clamminess, the racing thoughts at nighttime, if it's interfering with your sleep and your health, I think any of those things, if not a few of those things put to get combined, is really a good time to reach out for some support. I know with anxiety, we can certainly get really wrapped up in those automatic negative thoughts and the fear of the future that something will happen and go wrong. And I think untreated anxiety can certainly sometimes spiral a little bit. And it's not often I see a lot of clients who perhaps didn't reach out soon enough and are feeling really burnt out from their anxiety, because anxiety is a constant fight or flight mode. Our amygdala is often in overdrive. Cortisol is often shooting through our body. So it can have a lot of negative health impacts. So I really, really, really strongly recommend to reach out sooner rather than later. And if you feel, if you're kind of still not sure, if you're thinking, oh, you know, I'm still high functioning. I mean, high functioning anxiety, it's really hard to pick up on. And if you think, well, you know, I have high functioning anxiety, I can still go to work, I can still go to school, I can still hold down a job, I still have a partner, but I'm still feeling anxious. I think, yes, if you have to ask the question, then I think that that's, you probably know the answer already. And, you know, the sooner you reach out for help, the quicker you can kind of work through your triggers and your strategies. So you've really got nothing to lose to reach out sooner rather than later. So that would be my recommendation, is just to try it, to reach out for some support, and you know, you've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, wonderful. I think that is all we have time for, Kat.
Yes, it's been a big episode, but we hope you guys enjoyed, and we will be back in your ears probably next week annoying you guys. But it's been so fun recording with you, Amy. I've missed our antics.
Love.
And the next time we speak, you'll be a proud fur baby, and I hope that you put all the pictures on the PS Instagram. So if you do want to follow Amy's mum journey of being a dog mama, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters.
Yeah, and it will probably be our mascot for the Site Collaborative as well. So you may as well follow us over on the Site Collaborative. Yes. just for the but no, it will look like a bald, I don't know. I don't want to say rat, but it won't look it won't look cute when it first comes out of the womb.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure you'll still love it anyway. That's what mothers do. They love their child.
Unconditional love.
Unconditional love, Amy. Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in. If you want to see more from us, we're on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. I almost forgot that then. And on our online psychology clinic, The Psych Collaborative. I will leave all the links in the show notes, and we will see you guys next week.
Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for writing into us, guys.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.